From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. More than 90% of people think it's important to talk about end-of-life care. Fewer than 30% actually do it. That's according to the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, a Massachusetts-based independent nonprofit. The Boston Globe reports the four medical schools in Massachusetts have jointly agreed to teach students and residents how to talk with patients about what they want from life so future doctors will know how far to go in keeping gravely ill patients alive. And at least one of our guests today contends that ageism is one of the major drivers behind the avoidance of end-of-life conversations. Today, we're going to explore what role ageism plays in that conversation and in our larger culture. We'll also learn about the difference between palliative care and end-of-life care. Anne Glass is a professor in the School of Health and Applied Human Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She's also the coordinator of UNCW's gerontology program. Anne Glass, welcome back to Coastline.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Also with us, David Free. He's director of Lower Cape Fear Hospice's Palliative Care Services. Welcome, David Free.
Thank you.
And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Anne Glass, we had you on a past edition of Coastline about universal design, which is about adjusting spaces for people of all levels of ability. After the mics went off that day, we kept talking in the studio, and we took a pretty deep dive into ageism and the impact, how that shows up, and the impact that it has in our culture and on people. Can you just give us examples to start of ageism, how it shows up in our culture in ways that we may have kind of become desensitized to?
Well, I think ageism is extremely pervasive in our society and actually very deeply ingrained, and it's probably one of the last isms. Like, you don't say things that are racist or sexist, but people still say things that are ageist. And people just take it for granted and don't think anything about it. And easy examples are birthday cards, you know, that can be very negative and derogatory towards older people. Commercials, TV shows, the way older people are portrayed in TV shows is generally not in a positive way. And
talk about that. Tell us about a stereotypical character in a TV show that you think is a negative portrayal.
Well, I think it's often older people are shown as behind the times. They can't keep up with technology, for example. There was something on Saturday Night Live just the other night, which was a little bit funny, I will admit, but it was an Amazon Echo product designed for older people. And it had special features for the older people who told repetitive stories and so forth and couldn't remember the name of the machine. So you see it all the time, and it's just around us all the time, and we don't even think about it. And I think it has to do with the whole fear that we have in our culture, a fear of aging. And the unfortunate thing about that is because we're fearful about it, we avoid talking about some of these important issues that if we're all going to age if we are lucky. And so we need to just accept that and move on and start dealing with how can we make this the best it can be.
And just to be clear, why do you think that the jokes around aging are more harmful than they are funny? Is this just the new territory for political correctness, or is this really doing harm?
I think it's really doing harm, and I don't think it's new either. I think it's always been there. Perhaps we had more acceptance of older people and of death itself 100 years ago when it was more of an everyday kind of thing, and we had fewer older people, so you valued the older people that you did have. And now we have obviously more older people in our world now than we've ever had in history. So it's becoming a greater force to contend with. But I think we need to change the way we think about it. And one of the things about aging is for many people, it's going to be some of the best years of their lives, you know, in their 60s and 70s and into their 80s and maybe beyond. It can be, if they have resources and health is good, they can be doing things that they never were able to do before when they had children and jobs and so forth. So there is that period, which is very positive. But even given that, we all need to be aware of the fact that there will be a period toward the end of life when you're going to need some help. And that's when the palliative care can come in and long-term care as well.
David Free of Lower Cape Fear Hospice, you have been dealing with death from a variety of different angles for many years now. And how do you see the culture at large as perceiving this conversation around death? Why are people afraid to have the conversation?
It's an interesting question and something I don't know that I quite have the answer to yet, but that I'm continuing to ponder. I think a lot of it has to do with what Anne Glass has said. I think also that there's something about recognizing one's own mortality in dealing with one's own parents, that in order to have a conversation with one's parents or grandparents or the older people in our lives, one has to recognize their own mortality. It's an interesting fact that 80%, for example, of Americans say that they want to die in a home setting, but 60% are dying in acute care settings. There's a big disconnect. And I think part of the reason for that is that we're not having conversations about what's important to people. We're not having conversations, and we can't have those conversations until we admit the fact that we're all going to die and then start thinking about how we want that to be, how we want our last days, months, and years to look like.
How does that happen, that someone imagines they want to die at home, but then they wind up in an acute care facility?
A lot of systemic failures, really. The adequate supports, the education tools that they need, the understanding of what to expect, even accurate conversations with their providers about prognosis and how long someone will have, which are rarely held and often over-exaggerated for fear of diminishing hope. So there's, I think, a lot of factors that play into why that happens, and also a medical, I think, system that has hyper-focused on keeping people going, whether it be the right thing to do or not, or whether it's what the patient might want or not.
What do you mean when you say that there are maybe inaccurate prognoses given? Are you saying that doctors are telling patients they might have longer than they actually have?
There was an article in the American Family Physicians Journal that did a study on this, the reasons why the conversations aren't had, the barriers to advanced directive conversations, for example, and prognosis. And the suggestion was made that physicians will often over-exaggerate a prognosis by a factor of 2 or 3 for fear of diminishing hope, for fear of looking like they had somehow failed, for trying to emphasize a more positive outlook for patients and families. It's not ill-intentioned by any means, but that has been seen as an actual phenomenon. It actually is happening.
And what does that mean for the patient if the doctor tells them they have a couple of years possibly and they have 6 months?
Well, I'm sure you can imagine that when someone's told one thing, they make plans based upon that amount of time.
Have you ever seen that happen with anyone?
Multiple times. Recently, when I was working in Maryland, I saw a situation where a patient was told a period of time, and it was clear to me and other people that that was not the case. And so we had to advocate for a more honest conversation. And as a result, that patient was able to have her family member move a wedding up a number of months so they could attend it, because that was a very important moment for them. So I think the importance of the discussion is so that people can plan based upon a realistic prognosis, rather than diminishing hope, helping shift that hope to a hope for something that's realistic or possible.
Anne Glass, how is aging medicalized? What's the difference between getting older and starting to address some of those physical issues that arise versus what you would call medicalizing aging?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I really truly believe that is part of the problem. And I don't know exactly how that happened, but aging is just a normal part of life. It's not a sickness in itself. There are health problems that can come with aging, but they are not necessarily everybody's going to experience. So it's part of it had to do, I think, with our institutionalization of people. We in our country chose to, when people needed long-term care, we chose to put them in nursing homes, which were like a hospital base. And other countries like Denmark, for example, many decades ago, they chose to go a home care focus route, whereas we went the nursing home route. And it's only been in very recent times, actually 2014, for the first time that our Medicaid dollars, which I don't know if people in our audience are aware of this, but Medicare, which people are eligible for when they're 65 or above or have disabilities, Medicare does not cover long-term care in a nursing home. It covers it under short-term situations, but not the kind of care that most people are going to need for a couple of years, perhaps. And to get Medicaid coverage, you have to spend down out of your own pocket until you meet the income eligibility, and then Medicaid will pay for your care. And we have a high percent of people who end up getting on Medicaid because it's like $82,000 a year is the median price for a shared bed in a nursing home these days. So you can imagine people spend down to that fairly quickly for most people. So Medicaid becomes the main payer, and it used to be to get Medicaid to cover your long-term care, you had to go into a nursing home. But only recently, as I said, in 2014, we have actually tipped the balance so that more than half of the Medicaid long-term care dollars are now going to keep people at home and get home and community-based services. And that feeds into what Dr. Free was saying as well, as a way to help people die at home.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a discussion about end-of-life care and palliative care, two decidedly different things. If you have your own question for our guests today, you can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or at coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are now open. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about the challenges of having a deeper and broader conversation about aging and about end-of-life issues, what the barriers are to those dialogues, and why everyone benefits when we have those discussions openly. With us today, David Free, Director of Palliative Care Services for Lower Cape Fear Hospice. Also here today, Anne Glass, professor in the School of Health and Applied Human Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is also the gerontology program coordinator there. And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138 or at coastline@whqr.org. And Anne Glass, just before we went to break, you were explaining how in 2014 things had opened up in the United States a little bit for people to be able to use Medicaid dollars for in-home care as opposed to having to go into a nursing home kind of facility.
That's exactly right. And that's really huge for our country. And in fact, I think that also gets at one of the roots of our ageism is because people have such a horrible impression of nursing home care. And I'm, you know, there are very good people that are working in nursing homes right now today who are angels to the people that they are taking care of. But it's not a place anybody wants to go. You know, it's not something you wake up when you're 20 and say, I can't wait till I can go live in a nursing home. So the fact that we're finally kind of stopping that train and turning it around so that we're making it possible for more people to be at home, which is where they want to be, and it leads to being able to die at home as well if you can provide the care at home and keep them there. And Medicaid dollars are, as I was saying, they are one of the fundamental payers for long-term care. And I do want to make a point that the recent American Health Care Act that was passed by the House would actually put this at risk because it would cut the federal contribution to Medicaid. Medicaid is a state and federal combined program. It would cut the contribution to Medicaid by $839 billion over the next decade. And the Congressional Budget Office in March estimated that Medicaid spending would be reduced by 25% by 2026. And that would mean 5 million fewer people would be covered by Medicaid than are currently or would be covered under the Obamacare plan. So, and we don't even have the CBO estimates for this recent version of the act because those haven't been submitted yet. So I think our listeners need to be aware that this is at risk. We're finally getting to where we could help people stay, you know, support them staying at home, and we're going to lose out on that.
David Free of Lower Cape Fear Hospice, what is the difference between end-of-life care and palliative care? So often when we hear hospice, we think, oh, that's where someone, that's the service that comes in when someone is getting close to death. Is palliative care making people comfortable on the way towards death, or what is it?
Palliative care is a specialized medical care that provides care to people at any age or stage of serious illness. It is focused on providing pain, symptom management, support, and comfort to people in the context of that serious illness. But again, at any age or any stage, and it can be delivered while people are getting curative therapy or at the point where curative therapy is no longer possible or desired. It usually involves an interdisciplinary team which focuses on those specific areas, and these people generally have specialized training. Myself, I have a doctorate, but I'm also a nurse practitioner, and I'm board certified in hospice and palliative care. So again, palliative care, any age, any stage of serious illness, as opposed to hospice care. Hospice care is for patients who generally are in the last 6 months of their life, where there's no potential for curative therapy or they no longer wish curative therapy, and it's focused on that particular time frame. And then end-of-life care, I would suggest, is even a more narrow band of people who are really truly at the end. So when you think about palliative care, it is the full range of care from the point of diagnosis of serious illness through curative therapy to a point where someone might become last 6 months, which would then be hospice, to a point where someone's right near the end, and that would be end-of-life care. So I really want to differentiate between those things because I think some people think that they're the same and they're not.
So it's possible then for someone to take advantage of palliative care when they don't have a terminal illness, when it's something that they're going to recover from. And palliative care is also part of care for people who may be in that last 6 months of life.
It could be for any of those people. It could be. Again, focused on pain, symptom management, discussing goals, support of patient and family. But yes, if someone has a disease for which they might be cured, you still might be able to focus on pain and symptom management. A woman who, for example, has had breast cancer and has just had a mastectomy may have some edema or swelling in her arm and a lot of discomfort with that and need a lot of support around the body changes she's experienced as part of that procedure. Palliative care can be part of that, and she may very well recover and go on to live many years. That same woman in a different scenario may not be recovering and may still require palliative care while she's getting chemotherapy and active treatment. And then that same woman later on, let's say the chemotherapy is not successful, may enter a period where she's appropriate for hospice and then eventually end-of-life care. So it really is a continuum of care, with palliative care being right at the very beginning, along with curative therapies.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about palliative care, ageism, improving the quality of life for seniors, end-of-life discussions. With us to answer your questions today, Anne Glass, professor in the School of Health and Applied Human Sciences and coordinator of the gerontology program at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and David Free, director of palliative care services at Lower Cape Fear Hospice. If you'd like to ask your own question on this Thursday, you can call us at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. Kim from Sunset Beach, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is for, I guess, Dr. Free, but I guess it could be for both of them. It's about private versus nonprofit hospices. Have there been any studies that you're aware of that compare patient satisfaction or quality of care or any of those kind of things between private hospices and nonprofit hospices?
Good question. David Free.
Certainly there is data on outcomes for for-profit versus nonprofit. It's been a very newsworthy topic of late. the profit versus nonprofit. I work for a nonprofit organization and the only one in this region, and I'm very proud of that. Some of those data suggest that, for example, in the world of hospice generally only provides a certain envelope of care. And in the world of hospice, there is a greater chance that things that wouldn't traditionally be offered in hospice are more likely to be offered by the nonprofit than the for-profit. I can speak to that. Certainly services like music therapy, other types of adjunct therapies that can be very important to patient well-being tend to be offered more in the nonprofit setting versus the for-profit setting. But I don't know that I have the full answer to your question, no.
Thanks so much for your question, Kim. And we have Susie from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Hello? Susie, are you there? And we seem to have lost Susie. Looks like the note says she was asking about taking care of her parents at home. They died at Lower Cape Fear Hospice. And it sounds like she wanted to raise a concern, but we don't have her. So, Susie, if you want to give us a call back, you're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about dealing with aging in our culture, end-of-life questions, and palliative care. Here to answer your questions, Anne Glass. She is the coordinator of the gerontology program at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and David Free, director of palliative care services at Lower Cape Fear Hospice. You both raised your hands. You want to respond. Anne Glass.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's wonderful that we're having this conversation because I have become end-of-life care and palliative care has been a research interest of mine. And I've had personal experience as well, being with family members toward the end of life and at the time they died even. And people said, oh, it's good you were there because you knew what to do. But I didn't really know what to do the first time I was with my father-in-law when he died. And it made me realize that, you know, it was partly that I was willing to be there and that I was willing to be educated. And I had been trained as a hospice volunteer. But it made me think how important it is that we do have these conversations. And ideally, they should happen before there's a crisis situation, that we try to help people be educated about what does it mean to have CPR, for example, and some of the other options that you have at the end of life, so that when the time comes, you can make an informed decision about what's best for you and your loved ones.
Are there, getting back to this question around aging and how it impacts the way we take care of people in our culture, are there conditions that doctors wind up trying to treat as an illness, or that it's really just natural aging? Is there sort of a gray area there, getting back to the idea of medicalizing it? In other words, are there conditions that wind up getting missed by doctors? It's really just something that if there was more education around senior quality of life, this would be something that wouldn't be medicalized.
The things that come to mind perhaps could be, one is frailty. Some people do go through a course of frailty as they get older. There are, as you were asking about things that might be missed, and I think things that can be missed are medications that interact with each other and are causing people to have depression or other symptoms that, instead of being recognized as being caused by the medications, the physician just puts them on more medications to treat whatever that condition is. And that's obviously not helping. The more medications, I mean, that's a whole other issue for another day, but the more medications a person is on, every single one of them puts you at more risk. So you really need to weigh the benefit versus the risk very carefully. And the fewer medications you can be on, the better. So that's one of the things. And depression itself may be overlooked and missed by the physician. And sometimes that is something that people are dealing with, and it could be treated. And in that case, perhaps medication would be a good option for them so that they can deal with the depression, and then they start eating better and sleeping better and enjoying a better quality of life.
Do you think that physicians are more likely to overlook diagnoses like depression when it's an older person that they're trying to treat?
Well, sometimes many physicians have a lot of experience with older people, and I'm sure are very good at diagnosing what's going on. But I think sometimes we do write them off. You know, there's the old joke about when the patient coming in and saying my knee hurts, and the doctor says, well, it's just old age, and they say, well, my other knee doesn't hurt, so why, you know, it's the same age as this one. So there is a certain degree of that, I think, and so there is ageism in the healthcare system for sure. At all levels. And actually, physicians and everybody probably at all levels of healthcare need more education on this whole end of life thing, too, and what palliative care is and how the role of that plays into it. Because physicians typically may be slow to diagnose or refer patients to palliative care or to hospice care.
David Free of Lower Cape Fear Hospice, in that Boston Globe piece that I cited in the introduction about these four medical schools in Massachusetts now training their students and residents to talk with their patients about what they want out of life. Is that something that a person who's taking advantage of your services, Lower Cape Fear Hospice, specifically palliative care, would they undergo questions like that? What matters to you in life? What do you need to make life worth living? Can you kind of take us through what that would look like, sort of laying that out?
Well, sure. So a major part of what we do in palliative care in doing the pain management, the symptom management, and the support is to try to maximize quality of life. It's not for us as the providers to determine what constitutes quality for the individual. It's important for us to talk about their wishes, goals, and values so that we can help to figure out what's valuable to them and then help the care to reflect those values. So yes, we do engage in those discussions as they're appropriate. What someone might wish or want, for example, back to the breast cancer case, in the case where that woman's going to be able to be cured, is a very different conversation than the conversation we might have with that same woman 20 or 30 years down the road if it recurs and it can't be fixed. Those are different conversations, and that person's values and wishes will change over time. But opening the dialogue at the earliest time point normalizes those conversations. And I think that's an important thing for both us to do with our loved ones as well as providers to take the lead in doing with their patients, is to just make these conversations normal throughout the healthcare continuum, throughout the aging process. And I think also, if a provider doesn't bring it up with a patient, it's completely appropriate for that person to bring it up with their provider. I think patients tend to think about the worst in case scenario, and the range of that can be very scary. And I think by having a conversation, they can truly narrow what it is that they're dealing with and change what might be fear to maybe a bit more anxiety. They can transition from a fear of the unknown to maybe anxiety around a known just by having these conversations.
We have a question from Melva. She says, Wilmington is a desired location to retire. How does our community rank for serving the needs of seniors? And Glass.
Well, it's interesting because I am teaching a class this past semester on adjustment to retirement and later life, a graduate course. And I had my students, since I have recognized, I just moved here last year, but I recognized that this Cape Fear region really is a huge retirement destination. So we've started interviewing people about how they made that decision to move here from out of state and retire here. Because most people, the vast majority of older people, don't move very far from their homes, if at all. Most people want to stay where they are and age in place. But I think I can't say that I've seen Wilmington necessarily on any top 10 list as far as places to retire in terms of when you look at all of the kinds of things, healthcare and everything that they look at. Although I can say from the interviews that we were doing with our folks just this past semester that people were extremely satisfied with their move here, and they found it welcoming and had met a lot of people and gotten involved, and they were satisfied with the healthcare systems too.
She also asked what resources are available locally or state-based resources for folks to make changes to their homes for aging in place, universal design upgrades. And are there communities or properties here in Wilmington that are based on universal design, which is the idea that it's accessible to people of all abilities?
Well, when we did talk about this topic on an earlier show, I suggested that people contact the Area Agency on Aging. And I think we made the phone number available to on your website, perhaps. And they can help people connect with the resources that are available. It's fairly limited as far as financial support for these kind of changes, although in some cases, programs even such as Medicaid will help in some states. There are neighborhoods that have been built specifically for an older population, too, where they've given attention to having the one level and the no-step entry, and some of the universal design features have been built in. So there are communities like that in Wilmington.
David Free, Josh writes, what would you say is the number one complaint made by families as it pertains to hospice? What changes can be made to help families through these tough times?
If he's specifically talking about hospice, I guess one of the concerns that families have expressed to me is that not being told that they're in that window of opportunity to receive hospice services. Again, hospice is a benefit that can be for 6 months, the last 6 months of life, but it can also extend beyond 6 months of life, depending on how the person's doing. And to be only told about this benefit, because it is a Medicare and insurance benefit, in the last couple of days or weeks, most people I will hear say, geez, we wish we'd known about this sooner, because they'd gotten to a point of being exhausted or burned out or not knowing where to turn. So I think the largest complaint I get is not being made aware that a patient is eligible and appropriate for hospice so they can avail themselves of those services and supports.
And Anne had mentioned earlier in the program, too, that so much of this comes up in the context of a crisis. So when we come back from this break, I want to hear from both of you what people who are relatively healthy and active right now, the questions they should be asking themselves and deciding with their families. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of aging, ageism, end-of-life care, and palliative care. And when we come back from this break, it'll be your last chance to ask your own question. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. With us today for an exploration of aging, how we think about it, dealing with chronic diseases, and how seniors can improve the quality of their lives are Anne Glass, Gerontology Program Coordinator at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and professor in the School of Health and Applied Human Sciences. Also with us, David Free, Director of Palliative Care Services for Lower Cape Fear Hospice, and they're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us today by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, talked about the idea of for people who are relatively healthy right now and active, what are those things that they could sit down at the dinner table tonight with their family and talk about in a way that, you know, doesn't make it a morbid conversation, but just really opens up some of this stuff. Anne Glass.
I actually did a series of interviews with people about their experiences with death and dying, and I focused on a group who were sort of the baby boomer age. This was about 10 years ago now, and a group that was 70 and over. And I talked to them about the deaths that they had experienced in their life, but also I asked them questions about their advanced planning and how they had carried that out, if they had carried it out. And it was really interesting because it was kind of all over the board, and I came up with a sort of a way of thinking about it, that it's sometimes the parent who is willing or not willing, and sometimes it's the adult child who is willing or not willing. And if they're both willing, then you're great and you can have good conversations. Although even so, sometimes people said it was just having casual conversations instead of making it a big formal, you know, we're calling the whole family together.
Okay, we're having the death talk now.
Right, because a lot of times, you know, that's hard for people to do. And sometimes they said it was that they had one child they could talk to and maybe not another. And if they at least did that and they wrote down some of their wishes so that they had it in writing, that was helpful too.
It's David Free. How can people access this conversation? And is there something of a stigma as an adult child if your parent starts to talk to you about what they want when they die and on that slow march toward death? Isn't it natural for the child to say, oh, stop it. You're nowhere near that. We're not, you know, doesn't it feel, there's something about that that can feel sort of uncomfortable for a, and you said earlier, it's the child recognizing their own mortality, but how can you open that up?
So I think you're right. I think that children will say, oh, don't be morbid. Let's not talk about that. But to me, it's not a conversation about dying. It's a conversation about living and about how they want to, it's about reframing the way that we perceive it. It's about how they want to live the rest of their lives. And so I think in having the conversation, Lower Cape Fear Hospice, for example, has a program called Begin the Conversation, which literally, and the pamphlet's available online, literally helps people to figure out how to engage in these conversations. But it, I think the segue into it, the ease point into it, is starting off with just a question as simple as, if it came to a point where you couldn't make decisions for yourself, who would you want to make those decisions for you? That's appointing a healthcare power of attorney, really.
Now, I'm going to play the role of the parent for a second, the aging parent.
Right.
You're the kid.
Right.
And I'm going to say to you, well, it's not you. It's my other child. So I'm uncomfortable having that conversation with you. And now our conversation is shut down. Where do we go?
I don't know that the conversation shut down. I think it would depend on that and the relationship that child has with that parent. It might be a decision that makes sense. Maybe that one child is closer in proximity or is more communicative with that parent. So I think, I don't know, it necessarily has to shut down the conversation. I think sometimes choosing a child may not be the best decision. You might want to choose someone who's not going to be so emotionally affected by a crisis moment that they can keep their mind clear and represent your best interests. But in designating a healthcare power of attorney, I think the key feature is, one, choose someone who's going to be able to be calm in the crisis moment. Two, who's going to pay attention and honor your wishes. And three, is going to be capable of sitting down and talking with you about what those wishes are. I think those are the three key points in choosing the healthcare power of attorney. So when you designate someone, then you have to have the conversation to say, if in the event I can't speak for myself, these are the types of things that would be important to me. Recognizing that what you're experiencing now may change over time. So that conversation has to be layered, and a lot of what-if questions need to be answered. Well, what if this, and what if this? And again, getting back to our Begin the Conversations tool that we provide on our website, I think it does provide a lot of resources and tools for people to sit down and have these dialogues that can be very, very difficult.
Can you just give us briefly, have some callers who want to get to, but briefly some examples of what-if questions? So you mentioned, what if I can't make decisions for myself, the healthcare power of attorney. What other kinds of what-if questions?
What, for example, again, because these conversations are about quality of life, what would be enough quality of life? At what point would something be not enough quality of life for you that you wouldn't want us to aggressively maintain that? And I've heard variations in that. Some patients would say, as long as I can recognize my grandchildren, that's enough. Just keep me going. And I've had other people say, if I can't walk and talk for myself, then that's not something I would want you to aggressively maintain. So I think it varies by the individual and the situation that they're facing in that moment and what they anticipate might take place with their specific problem or disease process.
You're listening to Coastline. We're having a conversation about end-of-life issues, also about aging and improving quality of life for seniors. We're going to get to some of the new research in just a moment. But first, Eula from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I have a question. Yeah. I have a question for Ann Glass. Earlier, Ann, you mentioned that Medicaid will help to pay for in-home care. If you already have adult Medicaid, is that the same Medicaid that you're talking about, or are there two different types of Medicaid?
When you say adult Medicaid, what do you mean?
Well, that's what I have, adult Medicaid.
So that's help for people who are 65 and older. Is that what
we're... Medicaid covers different kinds of groups of people, but one of the groups that it will cover is people who are nursing home eligible. That is, they have a certain number of dependencies in their activities of daily living. And I don't know if you're talking about qualifying under that category? Because if you do, that would be the category where states have the flexibility to provide home and community-based care under home and community-based care waiver programs.
Is there a place that we could send Eula so she can talk about her specific set of circumstances and get some counseling about
it? The Area Agency on Aging at Cape Fear Council of Governments is what it's listed under, but they are always a good place to start when you want more information.
The Area Agency on Aging.
Yeah, Cape Fear Council of Governments.
Okay.
Where it's housed.
And we will also post that on our website when we put this up. Eula, thanks so much for your call. We have Dennis from Ocean Isle. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I actually had three questions. I think you've addressed two of them already. But if you have a demented senior, which we take care of, and she has moments of cognitive, and she has decided that she wants to leave. She's ready to go. This is not any quality of life that she really is interested in. And I understand that there have been in the past where the cognitive person has made the decision that I'm going to stop eating and we're going to get this done. And I guess they bring in the family in a period of over 5 days or so, it's all over. I don't hear too many people address that approach, which is the wish of the person that you're taking care of. Could you share a little bit out there about that kind of a thing?
David Free, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you for your question. I think the issue of dementia is a complex and multi-layered one. The issue that I have in the dementia world is one around what we call capacity, the ability to make autonomous and informed decisions. And as you said, very appropriately, people can what we call wax and wane. There can be moments of lucidity and clarity where someone might be competent in the world of dementia, and there might be moments where they are not. So I think the key issue, first of all, is to get a capacity determination to see if it's actually a capacitated decision to do that. But regardless of the capacity or not, any individual can make a conscious choice to not eat or drink. And if in the capacitated moment she's expressed that, then that is something that potentially the family could choose to honor. I would still, I think, as a family member, if it were me, provide that food and provide that drink and have that next to them so they can make that choice. Generally, when someone has made that choice and stops eating or drinking, we're talking in the order of a week to 2 weeks. And what would be important during that time, if that was a decision being supported by patient and family, is that they were able to receive at least palliative, if not hospice care, to manage pain and symptoms and comfort during that time. And that can be, that hospice care could be delivered in a home, it could be delivered in a nursing home, assisted living, or in a hospice care center.
Tell us, David Free, where palliative care is available. Is that something that's connected to a facility? Where can people take advantage of that?
So palliative care can be received in a patient's home, in assisted living and skilled nursing facilities, as well as in a hospital setting. And to access it, really, all that a patient needs to do is ask their physician to refer to the palliative care program, and then that extra layer of support will kick in. In a hospital setting, it would involve a team approach because there are interdisciplinary teams in our hospital at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. In the community, it would be probably a nurse practitioner coming and checking in on someone every couple weeks.
And I want to get to some of the ways that seniors can actually improve their quality of life in the years that they have, Anne Glass. There's new research that is pretty promising with a particular kind of diet. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I would like to share that. Actually, this is something I just became aware of in the last 6 months, and it is not getting any press, really. And I think the reason for that is because it's not a pharmaceutical. It's not a drug. Which, you know, if it were a drug and it had been approved, then the drug company would be all over the news with it. But what it is, some of you may have heard of the DASH diet and the Mediterranean diet that people have used to improve their health and heart conditions. And what what they did at the Rush Institute was to pull out the things that the foods that have the most impact on brain health. And they did a study, and this, what they call the MIND diet, M-I-N-D, the MIND diet, was very, very promising in, with people in maybe that were just beginning to have a little bit of cognitive impairment. The people who followed this diet had like a 55% less risk of decline, a slower decline, than the people who did not follow it. And what was also nice to see is that even if you moderately follow it, you had like a 33% or 35% decrease in your risk. So this is pretty significant. And they're doing, they did just get some funding in 2016 to do a larger scale study, but this was with about 1,000 people. So I think it's really a, it needs to get out there. So if I can take a minute, I'll explain what it is. It's very briefly, it's very easy to follow too. It's not anything you have to spend a lot of money, and it's certainly nothing that puts you at risk. It's a good diet to follow for all of us. And basically it's 3 servings at least of whole grains every day, one dark green salad type of thing, and one other vegetable, blueberries on most days, a glass of red wine every day, snack on nuts, and then have beans at least every other day, poultry at least 2 times a week, and fish at least weekly. And then there's a list of things to avoid, which are butter. They say use olive oil instead, cheese, fried and fast food, pastries and sweets. But you can still have red meat up to 4 times a week if you wish. And I just, I'm glad to have a chance to get that out there, because I think this is a good diet. It's not going to put you at any risk to follow it. And if it really does pay off in this decline, you know, keeping you from having cognitive decline, it would be well worth getting it out there.
David Free.
I would just do one small point along with that. I think it sounds very promising. I think that with any change in a diet, you'd want to check with your healthcare provider first before engaging in it. And my only caution would be with the leafy green vegetables, they might interfere with any anticoagulants that patients might be taking. So I think it's still a good idea to run it by your provider before engaging in, you know, a new diet.
And just in the minute or so that we have left, if you could leave our listeners with one thought about kind of opening up this conversation, removing the stigma around aging and around death, what would that be, Anne Glass?
Well, I just think it needs to be normalized. It needs to not be such a huge deal, and it needs to be something that we do talk about. And I find I talk about this in my classes, and then my students tell me later they've never had anybody talk about it with them before. And once we did in our class, they were able to then go home and have conversations with their parents. So I think it just is getting it out there and exposing people to it. And, you know, it's okay to talk about it.
And is there a way, David Free, that an adult child might open up a conversation with an elderly parent if that parent is kind of suffering from the stigma around ageism and doesn't want to talk about it and there's shame there?
Absolutely. I think the doorway to that is just, first of all, educating your listeners on the fact that the time to have these conversations is when someone is well and healthy rather than the crisis moment. Because there's nothing more sad to see as a clinician myself than being in an ICU where children are trying to decide what mom or dad might have wanted because they never had the dialogue. And we as clinicians and as healthcare system failed them because we never encouraged them to do it. So I think that the segue to the conversation is, mom, you know, you're getting older and I'm so glad you're doing well right now, but there might come a time when you're not. And I really want to know what would be important to you. So if there ever that moment ever comes, I know what to do. I think that's the way I would engage in that conversation.
Anne Glass.
I would just add, too, from the older person's perspective, you might think about it as something you can do to help your family. Because if you let them know what you want, it takes some of the burden off of them of trying to make these difficult decisions when the time comes.
I agree. It is a gift to your family to have these conversations.
Great point. That's this edition of Coastline. Anne Glass, David Free, thank you both so much for joining us today. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. You can get the podcast or find it on our HQR app. Or go old school and tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.